Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.
Good evening. From Akron, Ohio, Paul G.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Paul Gatick. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Paul.
Sobriety day, September 15th, 1991, and which is a couple weeks ago. I turned 32. I couldn't believe that. My home group is a Newburgh group, east side of Cleveland in the hood on Broadway and Harvard. They say you get a Harvard education at the Newburgh group, and it's like in the hood, kind of like a Lampton group, but it's... Sometimes we got to send people out to watch the hubcaps in the parking lot type of thing, you know. And my sponsor is a guy by the name of Tim T, and been my sponsor since the beginning. And it's through this fellowship, God, people like you guys, and a whole lot of other stuff that I'm here today. And I wasn't planning on any of this, of course, you know, and that's the usual deal, but... I caught it. I caught it early on. You know, before I go any further, I'd like to thank everybody. You know, really, I got to say, and I bet you some of you would agree, this is one of the friendliest conference committees that I have encountered. Can we give you guys... From the people at the registration table in the... To people like this, that countdown was great. I thought it was going so good. I thought you were going to go negative one, negative two. And we just saw good times throughout. From getting picked up at the airport, thankfully, Ron was a slacker and sent Eddie in my... Ron had to work. You got to do what you got to do. We understand that. I was just but Eddie... you know what? Thank you so much. You know, we spent an hour and a half together, and it's like, it puts me in mind of when I first came in. I wasn't all in all the way, but I went to my home group, and what was to become my home group. I didn't even have one. I had 2 weeks sober, and I walked up to the Newburgh group, and the first time I was there, and they had this little black lady, but she had 40 years sober. And she was giving her talk that night. You could hardly see her over the podium. And she was talking about how back in the 40s, she would come home drunk 3 o'clock in the morning from the bar and put on those Billie Holiday records, she said. And she put on those Billie Holiday records, and the tears would... And she went like this, descriptive. The tears would come streaming down her face. And I heard that, you know, and I could almost picture the purple parlor and the Victrola and hear the strains of Billy. 2 weeks later, I'm in the same meeting, and some guy gets up there behind a thing, and he says, you know, I used to come home in the 50s. They just developed hi-fi stereo, and I put those stereo speakers together in my living room car, put on those Frank Sinatra records, and those tears would have come streaming down my face, he said, and there it is again. You know, and I'm saying, well... I start to think, though, I used to come back home in the 60s and in my bell bottoms and paisley, and I'd put on those Jimi Hendrix records with those big old Cass earphones, and those tears would come streaming down my face. And I started, and it was my first moment of identification, I guess. You know, they didn't look like me, these people, and they didn't act like me. They didn't, their tastes weren't the same. I had Billie Holiday, Frank Sinatra, I was a Hendrix guy. But there was something deeper that connected us all. I'm going to talk to the new people here tonight, you know, and I might even say it a couple of times, but I like talking to new people, you know. And so if you're new here and you got an iPod with the earbuds and you come home and it's Lady Gaga or something at 3 o'clock in the morning and the tears come streaming down your face, you just might be one of us, you know. I'm just saying. Just saying, just give us a chance. But back to Eddie, you know, alcoholics are the only place where total strangers can reminisce. You know, like we've known each other all our lives. It happens in an airport. It happens in a coffee shop. You know, 10 minutes later, Eddie and I are in the car telling, sharing stuff we wouldn't tell our priest, you know, and we just met, you know. Just. But Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a great life, and I'm going to start drinking here soon. But one thing, if you're new, if I don't die, or if I don't quit, or if I don't get fired by next March 18th, I'll have 50 years at my job in the steel mills back in Cleveland. You know, right? You know, that doesn't happen much anymore. You know, it's like, whoa, I can't believe when I say that. But nonetheless, I remember I was thinking back, and I've reflected on that lately, but when I was new, you know, I was 21 years old, and I'd go in, and it was a steel mills, a rough industry, and they got coal. They used to burn coal, and they had big fields and conveyor belts, and in the middle of the winter, it's Cleveland. You know, there's 18 inches of snow, and, you know, the wind's blowing, and we're all in our full Carhartts when we go out there to fix these things because they'd freeze up, and they'd ice up, and you got to keep them rolling. So I'd go out there with the old-timers. I was an electrical guy, and we'd go out there, and we'd be carrying the big old tools, big tools, you know, steels, big wrenches and stuff. And I'd put the wrenches down, and I'd be watching the old-timers work, and I'm over here going like that, you know, and I'm freezing out there. And the old-timer looked up at me and says, "Kid, the heat's in the tools. The heat's in other words, get off your butt, pick up a tool, and do something, you know, the heat's in the tools." And I got that then, and I'll tell you, if you're new here now, the heat's in the tools. You know, the heat is in the tools. It's in the steps. It's in the service. It's in even more than that. You know, it's in the pushing in the chairs when you get up out of it. You know, just the simple things. Wherever you got to start. You know, the heat's in the tools here. The sponsor, the God, the prayer, everything we do. You know, it changed my life, and it'll change yours too. And there's a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of enthusiasts in here who changed that too. So anyway, you might even win one of these things over here. You never know, you know. But I wish I could. I couldn't get it on the plane though. So, but I bought them anyway. So anyway, I had good people. Somebody was talking about praying. Somebody was getting prayed. I think it was Johnny. Somebody getting prayed in here. By the way, all the speakers. Todd last night was great. He gave us a great thing. I never shed a tear at an H&I thing before. But damn, you know, and I know what we're getting with Amy tomorrow morning. You know, I was just spending all weekend trying not to piss her off. You'll know what I'm talking about. You'll hear what I'm talking about tomorrow morning, you know. But yeah, and everybody's been great, and the Al-Anon lady, it's been a great weekend so far. You know, just good feeling all around, and we like that. But so anyway, prayed into this program. Parents, good parents. You know, it's my dad was a cop. He was a Cleveland cop. My dad, there's enough gray hair here. My dad was Elliot Ness's bodyguard. Back in the 40s, Elliot Ness was safety director in Cleveland for a period of time. My dad was an overachiever, and he drew the good duty. And my dad was a trained interrogator. You know, I was a liar. It didn't work real well at all. My mom was a church lady. She prayed me into this program, you know. But my dad was ideals and values and, you know, just structure and good stuff. And I had a brother who was 10 years my senior. My brother was 10 years older than me. And this was back in the 50s. My mom had me in her early 40s. And that just wasn't done. So I'm starting to think, you know, I'm putting two together, you know. They had him, and then they waited 10 years. And I don't think that was planned. You know, I think I was an accident. You're not supposed to laugh. You're supposed to say, "Aw." See, there we go. Anyway, so I think, but you know, so it was always, he was a smart kid. You know, he's the kind of kid that graduated from the same high school that he started at. I went to 5 different high schools in my career. Smart. And I was supposed to follow in his footsteps. Why can't you be like your brother? Why don't you work up to your potential? Why don't you all this and that? So he was entering graduate school, and I was just entering high school, and they thought, my parents, that it'd be a good idea to send me away to visit him at college, that I'd follow in his footsteps, that I'd follow his example and work on, and enjoy the college atmosphere, you know, so I'd have something to strive for. It was a good idea in theory. The only problem, when they put me on the plane, college was in Berkeley, California, and the year was 1967. And I learned that was a summer of love, if you remember that, you know. And he was over on the Berkeley, he was a nuclear guy, counting his nuclear particles. I was over at Haight-Ashbury counting other stuff, if you know what I mean. And those were the 2 weeks that were to change my life. You know, that's what sent me on the wrong way. You know, and here I am, AA, right? So I came back to enter high school, and I my mind was 2,500 miles away. I lasted about a year and a half. I was on my third high school already, and I'm thinking, you know, I had seen the mountaintop. I'd seen, it was all happening on the coast. It was on the front page news every day. One day I just decided that's enough's enough. I decided to run away from home. I bought a one-way plane ticket to San Francisco for $60. I packed my guitar and I packed a suitcase and I got on that plane. You know, go west, young man. You know, I was, and really I was thinking, you know, I'm a kid from Ohio. I'm thinking I'm gonna go west. I'm gonna live on the beach. You know, I've seen Gidget, you know. I'm thinking beach balls and bonfires and stuff like that. You know, most of you probably know, evidently, the Northern California coastline is not conducive to living on the beach. You know, I was freezing, the wind is, you know, the fog coming in off the ocean. I was miserable, you know, there's fog horns, sea lions barking all I was in the shadow of the Golden Gate Bridge in the woods above Cliff House on a coastal highway. And it was beautiful, but I couldn't stand it anymore. I lasted about 3 days. 3 days, and I zipped up my suitcase, closed my guitar, picked them up, and I walked as far east as I could walk. It was only about 5 miles if you're in San Francisco, you know. Now you're on the Embarcadero, now that you're on the inside of the bay. You hit more water, you know, and that's as far as I could. And that was when the Embarcadero was really still a waterfront, you know. They've cleaned it up a lot since. It's fancy now, but then it was like an old Marlon Brando movie, you know, the fog, and they still had the wooden wharves, and you could hear those wharves creaking against the pilings, and when the tide had come in and out, and the pitter-patter, the wharf rats all night long, it was pretty cool, and neon signs flashing all night long, and winos beating each other up, and that's where I went, you know, I liked it, it was raw, and it was exciting, and that's where I met Charlie, and Charlie was going to be he was kind of like my street sponsor, you know, for lack of a better term. Charlie's the guy that taught me an appreciation for cheap Rock Gut supermarket wine. Mad Dog wine. You got Mogan David wine? I love a murmur of approval at the mention of Mad Dog wine. You know, my people, you know, I know that. So, and Charlie taught me valuable skills, how to wrap that paper sack up around that bottle nice and tight so it, you know, you would keep the other winos couldn't see your levels and they wouldn't see what you got. You know, they weren't always chasing you down for a slug off your bottle and other stuff. You know, we used to have we have moments of clarity, and somebody was talking about that earlier in the weekend. These where we have a flash of recognition, we see the truth. We see the truth for what it really is, and it even cuts through our alcoholism or whatever. These flashes of reality, and I had one on the foot of Market Street, downtown San Francisco. It's 6 in the morning, Charlie and I are sitting on his curb, killing our bottles from the night before, and we're watching the city awaken. We're watching the limousines come, the ivory towers. The CEOs are getting out of them, people doing responsible things, good things. These are good people. They're well-dressed. They're taking care of their families. They're paying their house notes, and and we're looking down at them. You know, they're tools of the establishment. They're servants of the man. You know, they don't know what life's all about. We know what life's all about, and we raise our bottles, and we slug down the last of them. We were looking down at them from the gutter, you know, which is what we were doing. And at that moment, I had this flash of realization, this moment of clarity, that this is skewed thinking. There's something wrong with my logic here. You know, we're the slackers. They're the good people, but as we were always apt to do, I was able to wash that realization down my throat with the last kill off of that bottle. And I remember that to this day. And on Friday nights, we go up to a little dance hall above the Cadillac dealership to hear the house band. Dance hall is called the Fillmore. House band was called the Grateful Dead, and they started playing. 8 or 9 in the evening, you know, wind up 2 or 3 in the morning, and yeah, Grateful Dead and the Fillmore. It was pretty cool. You know, Janis Joplin, Big Brother, they were all there, man. Golden Gate Park and Sunday afternoons, we go over to Berkeley, Provo Park, Country Joe, and Jefferson. They were all there, and it was. And I planned on going to Berkeley, and I planned on following my brother's footsteps. Next week, I swear to God, no more than 2 weeks. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to start studying. I'm going to plan my future. But it never happened. Never happened because before I knew it, the Berkeley police walked up at me on telegraph and I was in the state without a legal guardian. That's against the law. I was a runaway. And the next thing I know, I'm getting off the plane in Cleveland Hopkins Airport, and there at the bottom of the gangplank is Elliot Ness's bodyguard. You know, and I'm like fresh off the coast, you know, my hair and all that. And you know, here comes the structure, here comes the discipline, and man, I was just waiting for it. But it didn't come. It didn't come for some reason. I thought I beat them. I thought, I was expecting the ride home to be torture, and they were just, I know today what the dynamic was. My parents, they just loved me enough to let me go at that moment. And I know today it takes a lot of love for a parent to love their child enough to let them go in that fashion. They didn't want me taken off. I was wild and they knew it. So, of course, I took advantage of that at every turn. And I ended up going back to high school because, you know, I picked right back up where I left off with my buddies. I ran with them. I told them all the exotic tales and strange happenings that happened out at the coast. Some of them were even true. Most of them were not, and I ended up graduating high school, you know, after 3 years to enter the job market. My first job was in the pharmaceutical industry, so to speak, and that's all I say about that from this point. But I was a janitor. Then I became I got a job as a janitor, and I thought this was a menial labor. You know, this type of work is beneath a person of my stature. I did not yet know that all work is honorable. You know, it might be temporary. My circumstances at any given moment in life might be temporary, but I thought this was beneath. They thought I was working there. I was casing a joint, actually. It's a vocational school, and I'm going to steal all their sawzalls or auto body tools. I forget what, and I had it all planned out on Friday night, but I never made it because Thursday found me in jail for assault on a police officer with a deadly weapon. You know, and I'm not a violent person at heart, and I come from a law and order family, but on that particular day, I saw this guy standing between me and my drink. The plans were made, the party was set, we had the liquor. I didn't want anything interfering with that, and something snapped inside of my head, and it was just like you see on TV today, America's Wildest Police Chases, you know, through suburban streets, over people's front lawns, in hot pursuit, you know. My escape vehicle was a 66 Volkswagen Beetle. They'll never take me alive, you know, with a slip and ponytail flying out the window. And they did. I'd seen Bullet. You know, I figured I got this, you know, but they didn't. And they got me. But something happened. I got a break. I got a break. They made a technical error. Excuse me. Boy, that was good food, too. See, I'm not supposed to eat before I get up. They made it, so I got a break, and I got off of that for some kind of way. I'm looking at a room full of people who all got breaks that they squandered, I bet you. And I said, I beat them too. You know, I beat them too. So that's what happened. And with that first job, I bought myself a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, and with that, I bought myself a lifestyle. And most of my adult life was devoted to building and drag racing Harleys and everything that went along with that. I don't get into that, but that's the way that was. But I was having fun. I was having fun, and I ended up getting a job in the steel mills down there. I was trying to stay out of trouble for the most part. And what I liked about the steel mills is a strong union job, of course. And they got the flats, what they call in Cleveland, and it's like this big bowl, kind of like this, kind of like the Antelope Valley, but you know, not that big. And they had bars surrounding the top of it, and bars everywhere up there. And I used to love bars with dark corners because I don't like people. and I'm antisocial, and I don't know how to get along with people. You know, I'm a square peg in a round hole, and a trapezoidal peg in a, you know, I just don't get it. I'm crude, I'm rude, I'm abrasive. I'm always overshooting or undershooting the mark, as with the Volkswagen. I didn't have to do all that stuff, but I'm not fitting. But I already found out that the alcohol would knock off the peaks and the valleys. You know, I had known that already. So because I'm drinking with all my buddies, and we graduated to the bars, and now I'm bar drinking, and now I'm going into dark corners because I don't like people, and I remember. It started happening right away. You know, I had a bunch of, we got our bikes together, a bunch of my road dogs, guys we grew up with. I'm in my mid-20s already, and they're starting to go a little bit here and there. And I'm not making any new friends, but I'm losing friends. Donnie was beat to death behind a bar in Broadview Heights with a baseball bat to the side of his head. And Frankie died from cirrhosis, and Stanley died from pancreatitis. And Eddie died with a bullet in the back of his head down in the flats. And Butch died, beat to death in front of the methadone clinic down on Carnegie. Ricky and Robbie died 100 miles an hour in the back of a Harley. Pat died on the Mexican border doing a run. Precious died, hotshot drug overdose. Bill died, we don't know how he died, and we just know he did. 17 of my closest friends, and I stand here speaking in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can damn well betcha. I believe this thing, do this or die. Do this or die. And I pray to the new people that you find something like that, because there's some kind of magic that happens. I think that's a lot of what, and this is personal opinion, but I think there's some kind of magic that happens when you get a bunch of people together that believe they survived a near-death experience, type of like Titanic survivors. You know, those people party. And so do we. And so do we, you know. So... And that's the way that was going. So I'm becoming more and more alone, and I'm sitting in these bars with dark corners, and trying to stay out of trouble. And the barmaid would come back, and I'd get a double shot of Jack, and I knocked that back, and I could feel the tension just drain out of my shoulders. You guys know the feeling, you know. It's a little better, and I get another double shot, and that's even better, and I might move up a stool or two out of that dark corner. And by the time I got five or six in me, I'm up by the cash register, quarters on a jukebox, quarters in a pool table, looking people in the eye, talking, having fun, telling jokes, and being part of the human race, you know. But the only problem was, and if I could have just nursed that, if I could have just, it's my sweet spot, you know, if I could have just kept that open a little bit and slowed that, if I could have just slowed down. You know, ice, no ice, I tried it all. Gin, vodka, vermouth, wine, beer, whatever. I tried all the techniques to try to slow myself down, but there was no, once I had the first one in me, there was no brakes, there was no governor. And the five would turn into 10, the 10 would turn into 15, and my pool shots failing me, and my jokes were falling flat, and now I'm working my way back down to the end of that bar where I'd spend the rest of the night in solitude and isolation because I didn't need those people anyway. And I didn't like those people anyway. And that's, this little ballet or this little play or whatever you want to call it worked itself out night after night starting now for my early 20s for years. It started going on for years, you know, months and weeks and, the time's flying by. I could see the papers flying off the calendar, and my life revolved around that, you know. And that was my only solace and my only comfort. And so the high point of my life was the period of time between 5 and 10 drinks. Everything outside of that little 45 minutes was dark and gray and gloomy, you know, and it was all geared to that moment. And that's the way I live my life. I tried to stay out of trouble. I got a few scrapes here and there, but eventually, I guess you could just say, I know what it means when they say to make a federal case out of something. Yeah, it was not good. And the feds are, they don't play. You know, they don't play. Some stuff came up, wreckage of the past, and I found myself standing in front of a federal judge. You know, and I ended up looking at the federal penitentiary. 5 years in Marion, Illinois, federal penitentiary. And for the old timers here, it was the ATF, not the DEA. I'm a real alcoholic. Just saying. Just clarification. Not that I didn't sit across the table from the DEA a time or two, but this particular one was the ATF. And I got one of those electronic monitors around. Anybody here got a monitor around their ankle? There's usually one. Oh, lightweights. Anyway, so I got that monitor on my ankle, however, they knew I had a job, so they gave me 45 minutes to get to the job in the morning, 45 minutes to get home in the afternoon, and I don't know about you guys, it's just about enough time to stop and have one, right? Yeah, and they're way ahead of me already, you know, so that was it. I stopped and had one, and I feel that relief draining on my things, and I tried to slow it down, and you know where, then 2:30 in the morning, find me on my hands and knees blowing lunch behind a place, because there is no slowdown, you know, and there is no going home once I light the fuse. And I know full well my life hang in the balance. I know full well that there's 5 years in Marion, Illinois looking at me. But I can't do anything about that. I have no control. Phenomenon of craving starts as soon as I take that drink. I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. And there's nothing I can do about that. So there I am. There I am when they call me in there. That lasted about a week, and they called me because the monitor kept on beeping off their desk, and they sat me down in front of two federal guys. And the guy, he went like this. He says, you know, you're defying an order of the court. You're flaunting the authority of the judge. And all I'm hearing is blah, 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 blah. And then he says, however, we'll give you a choice. He says, either you get help or you go to jail. And he went like that with his hand. And I said, could you repeat that, please? He says, all right. He says, either you get help or you go to jail. I said, could you give me a week to think about that? Literally. And it was. It sounds like an exaggeration, but it's not. That's exactly what I asked the guy, because what they didn't know is I'm already in jail. The guy mentioned the hamster wheel Friday. You know, I was on a hamster wheel that I was tired. I was tired of my life. I was tired. You know, for years I was trying to survive. You know, it was raw survival. I was tired of the life I was living. I was tired of the bills. I was tired of the police. I was tired of the trouble that I had been in all my life. The landlords and everything. All the problems I had. The job. The bosses. Everything. It was all a struggle, and there was some degree of solace or comfort that I realized in my head. If my life was taken out of my hands, they'd tell me when to go to the rack. They'd tell me when to go to chow. It'd be easier, you know. For 5 years, I'd get off of this thing. But I guess I figured I could, if I still had EAP, and I said, all right, I'll get your help. Give me a week to make arrangements, because get my affairs, as if I had some affairs to get in order. And I did. So they said, okay, and I made the arrangements, and I ended up going out. I booked a berth out at a place by the Pennsylvania border, a treatment center, if you will, I guess is what it was called. And, you know, and I hope I never forget the state of my life, what it had devolved into, you know. And I gloss over it a lot, and it ended up, you know, I was like living like an animal in a cave. I had this apartment, and there were empty bottles and dirty dishes in the sink, empty bottles on the floor, blankets covering the windows, keep the sunlight out, bags of garbage. You know, I had garbage people come at 8 in the morning. I wake up 2 in the afternoon, so week after week after week. And the flies would start at the oldest ones, and they'd work their way up to the newest ones. You know what I'm saying? The toilet was stopped up. I used it anyway. The shower was stopped up. I didn't bother using it. Dirty clothes, you know, 2 weeks in my underwear. Is this an overshare? it gets worse. Gums, you know. I was dying. I was like an animal in a cave. You know, and I knew no out. I knew nothing about it. And that was the state of my life when I walked out of my life and I walked in through your doors. And it was beautiful. It was, you know, so I went to that place. And sure, you know what, let nothing I say diminish anything that the medical community has to offer anybody in this room. You know, it was good. It was valid. You know, and they had the MMPIs, and they had the psychological evaluations, and they had Jahari's window, and they had the chalk talks, and the circle of addiction, and all the psychological stuff, and they had a bunch of pink-cheeked, fresh-faced counselors there churning them out. This is the early 90s, you know, the treatment center industry is in full swing, and they were good. You know, they were fresh out of college, and they knew their craft. They knew who I was. They knew more about me than I knew about myself, and I recognized that. You know, and I started to get pretty optimistic about that. You know, maybe these people can fix me. Maybe they are right. And I saw where they were right. You know, but after there was something missing. And I couldn't put my finger on it. There was something missing that, you know, and my optimism started to wane a little bit. And I ended up questioning, this isn't going to work either. You know, it's... And I started to lose hope, you know. And what I know that they didn't, you know, they didn't. These counselors, they didn't know what it felt like. They didn't know four horsemen, you know, terror, frustration. They didn't have that. You can't teach that in a college course. They didn't know what it felt like to stare at those empty eyes looking back at you from a mirror, from a barroom mirror, where I'm chained to that bar stool. The whole everybody else in the world on a summer afternoon is living their lives and being vital, and I'm looking out those windows at that bar, and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm not going anywhere because I'm in the middle of my drinking, and I look at those eyes staring back at me, and they're hollow and they're lifeless, and there's no hope there. They didn't know what it felt like when I had to go to the blow lunch in the bathroom, and you put your arms around that porcelain. That toilet bowl, and you're kneeling in that wet, whatever that wet is on the floor, and you know what I'm saying, I guess, and it's cool, and it kind of gets kind of cool, that cool porcelain, especially after you flush it a couple times, it gets the dew on the side, and your cheek rubs up against it, and it's a little refreshing. If you're in here and you can name three commercial bathroom fixtures, you're not a plumber, you just might be an alcoholic. Just saying. Crane, American Standard, and LK. All right, don't think about it. But there was one guy who did, and his name was Dave, and Dave was to become my primary counselor. And Dave had 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Dave had a federal thing, and we shared so much. And when Dave spoke, it was different. There was something Dave knew. And Dave was my first experience with one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, which is so crucial to me. And it changed my life. And so when Dave talked, I listened. When Dave told me that I had to promise him I'd go to a meeting my first night out of the place, I resisted, because I don't make promises, I break promises, Dave. And he said, no, he wouldn't stop. So I said, okay, Dave, I'll promise you. First night out of this place, I'll go to a meeting. And now can I go get something to eat? Oh, he said, okay. And then I went to my first AA meeting. And it was an in-house meeting in a treatment center. The people from the surrounding community brought a meeting in on Wednesday nights, and Dave told me to go to the front and welcome the people coming in, bringing the meeting in at 6 o'clock. So I did. And he said, smile, too, you know, because I wasn't smiling at all. So I went out there, and I'm shaking hands. I knew nothing. Never been to a meeting. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And the guy walks up to the first guy out of the parking lot, and I said, thank you for bringing the meeting to our facility tonight, you know. And another guy walks up. I said, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come and bring, as I'm shaking his hand, I'm looking over his shoulder, and I look in the parking lot, there's a beautiful woman gets out of her car. And she gets out, she closes her, she walks up through the parking lot, she's going to the meeting. Wow, and she comes up to me, wow, women suffer too, evidently. And she gives me this firm handshake, she looks me right in the eye, you know, and she's got the flashy white teeth and this beautiful smile, and she walks into the meeting that night, and she's the speaker. Turns out she's the speaker, you know, and I'm sitting in the back of the room. Everybody goes in, and they start the meeting, and she's giving her talk up there. And I'm still in and out. I'm 17 days off the streets at the time, and I'm still half in a fog. I had just gotten out of detox after 17 days, actually. And as she's talking, it occurred to me, you know, these people tricked me. This tree, you know, they showed me where everything I thought was right was wrong. You know, everything I thought was up was down, but they were right. The more I thought about it, they were right. My dreams were hollow. Everything I thought, they turned my whole reality upside down. Paradigm shift. They turned everything upside down. And at that moment in my life, the only thing I knew for certain at that moment in my life is that she wanted me. I could tell. Typical new guy. Typical new guy. You know, I could tell by the look in the eyes. I could tell by the firm handshake. We know these things, right? New people. And in the space of an hour, that woman did her job in Alcoholics Anonymous. She carried a message of strength and hope from the heart that she changed my mind. She changed my, in the space of an hour, she changed my, she walked out of that place that night and a child of God, you know, worthy of respect. And from that day to this, I've had respect for the power of the podium in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, to be treated with dignity. And that's what I had. That's all I had with me. After 22 days, the treatment center van dropped me off of my car. They gave me a big book and a meeting schedule. And as the van's driving off into the sunset, I opened up that meeting schedule, found a meeting where I knew where it was. I turned the key on the car, and the car started. And I put down the meeting schedule, and I reached in my pocket. I had $10 in my pocket, and it was the last $10 I had in my life. And I don't know, it was a sunny day. I had 22 days sober. I had $10. The car's running, and it sounds like a celebration to me, you know. And I'm on the street a half hour, and I'm walking in the back door to Finn Cafe up on Broadway to celebrate. No mental defense. You know, as I'm walking in there, I'm thinking, after all the knowledge that they gave me, after all the self-realization, after all I found out about myself, am I crazy? Why am I doing? After all those good people's efforts, I'm still walking up there. And I sit down at the bar, and the barmaid comes and she says, "What do you have?" And something snapped inside of me, and I said, "Give me a wash." I almost said double jack, but I said, "Give me a wash." And at the time it took her to walk from here to that water bottle over there and pour a multi-flow, squirt her thing in half a glass of ginger ale. She comes back and says, "What do you have?" Thought crossed my mind. Says, "You know, I promised Dave I would go to a meeting on my first night. I'd never been to a meeting. I didn't know whether you guys had breathalyzers here or what. Maybe I should just go sober, scope out the lay of the land. Just check it out, because I still got the feds to keep happy. I don't know what's going to happen with that, and I'm not physically ill." So at that thought, I put a dollar up on a bar. I got up off the bar stool and went out to my car, and I picked that meeting schedule up again. I found where a meeting was, and I drove around the corner from that thing and waited there for 5 hours behind a shopping center. 5 hours I sat in my car watching the rapid trains go back and forth to the airport, and when 7 o'clock came, I turned on the key and I drove around the corner and walked down the steps of a church basement for the first time in my life to a meeting in the wilds. You know, and I'm walking down those steps in jeans and boots and chains and leather and Marlon Brando look on my face to keep people away and hide the fear, which is really what the mechanism was. I get to the bottom, it says, little blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid standing at the bottom of the steps, looks me up and down. Says, "Are you new?" I don't know how they know. I don't know how he knew this, but he nailed me. He said, "Don't worry about it. Grab a coffee, grab a donut. Meet us by the table over there." They had round tables just like this. So I did. I followed instructions. I grabbed a coffee, donut, and met him by the table. And I'm looking around. My back's against the wall. I'm watching the door, but I'm looking at, and the people didn't look like. They didn't look like me. They didn't act like me. It was, but there was something, and I've given it a lot of thought from that day to this. What gave me some sense of belonging? That's the only way I can describe it. I felt strangely amongst my own. I mean, there's little old ladies and old guys and kids and there were a few people my age, but somehow I felt a part of this, a part of it. And it was indefinable, and it piqued my interest, I guess. And that's all really. And what they did, walking out the door, they gave me 5 phone numbers, and that's what I had walking out of that meeting. Some vague sense of comfort, some vaguer sense of belonging and five phone numbers. And I walked out of that place and I'm thinking, you know, that wasn't so bad. Let me see if this works again the next day. So I went home, and the next day I didn't drink all day. And it was a rainy October day in 1991. And I hear the clock ticking on the wall, and I'm looking at that nasty old apartment that I'm living in, junk all over the place. And I'm looking out the window, and it rains, because now it starts getting dark, you know. And I still got that $9 in my pocket, and I said, well, I better use one of these phone numbers. So the first guy's name on the list name was Bill, so I call Bill on the phone. I pick up somebody answers on the other line, a woman. And I said, hey, I met Bill at the meeting last night. Is he there? And she says, are you new? And there it is again. What's with this? ESP or what? You know, I'm thinking, I don't know. I said, yes, no, maybe. She said, no, Bill is not here. He just went out. I'll have him call you when he gets back. I hung up the phone. I said, I knew it. I knew this thing wasn't going to work. I still had four more numbers on the thing, but I knew this thing wasn't going to work, and I'm putting on my leather, and I got the $9, and I'm walking for the door, you know, and I'm looking out that door, and I had a window on the door, and I could see the rain bouncing off under the streetlight in the corner. You know, you ever see that movie The Matrix, like the guy pulls up, Neo, he pulls up under the bridge, and the rain's coming down, and the lady got a gun to his head, and he gets out of the door, and he looks down a warehouse road, and it's desolate, and it's deserted, and she says, you know what's down that road. And I knew what was out that door. You know, I was just about ready to, and I grabbed the doorknob, and the phone rings. I let go of the doorknob, went back, pick up the phone, and it's Bill. He called me back. I couldn't believe it. He says, why don't you come on over? I just went out and got some pizza. He says, we have a little big book study here on Thursday nights. We eat some pizza, tell some lies, smoke some cigars, have a few jokes, read some big book. And I responded well to the pizza. And he made it sound just attractive enough that the next time I grabbed that doorknob, I had a name and address of a pocket of enthusiasm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had a drink since. I mean, I had a drink since, and I got in the car. I went over to these guys. They were all a good 10 years younger than me at the time, or more. But they invited me along with them on their journey, you know. My journey started in Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave me the AA etiquette. They tell me where to go, which meetings to go, which are the good ones, which are the how to act in the meetings. Go to the bathroom first, you know. Don't be disrupting everybody, you know. Get involved, do something, try to find some kind of way to do something. And I didn't know anything, but I started feeling pretty good, you know, and I started coming along. I still wasn't all in, but, you know, one of the most important things I heard early on, you know, I wasn't reading Big Book yet. I didn't have a God yet. I didn't have a prayer life yet. I didn't even have a sponsor yet, for real. And one of the most important things I heard was the concept of not saying no to Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody said, you don't say no to, somebody told me that. They literally said, you don't say no to Alcoholics Anonymous, Paul. I was living in an Oxford house, a three-quarter way house for guys. And a phone call came in to the Oxford house where I was staying. I was a week sober, maybe, a week in the place, a week out of treatment. And somebody said, hey, the Brook Park Monday group, the treasurer stole the treasury, moved to Florida, they need coffee. It happens every now and then, you know. No big deal. But it sounded like a suggestion to me. It sounded like they need coffee help. So I said, I could do that. And I got off of the couch, let the other guy stay there. And I started up the car, and I went, and I went to Brook Park Monday and helped him make coffee. And while I'm doing it, I hear some guy mention this other guy's name by the name of Tim. And just a chance occurrence, the guy's name graced my ears, and I asked him the question. I looked into it a little bit, and I found out he was chairing a West Clifton group that month in Lakewood, and I went over there and found out it was my Tim. I knew this guy to be a pretty sharp operator out in the street, and if this guy's in AA, raised your credibility a little bit in my eyes. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he's my sponsor to this day. And that's the way it works. This is my own set of miracles here, I'm telling you right now. And I believe everybody here has your own set of miracles, unique to your situation, unique to the paths that you walk, in life. They're all different, but and I didn't realize any of these things, and I didn't see them as miracles when they were happening, but it's in the looking back on it that we see this. But I had to walk the path to pick them up, and we do. New people, you got to walk the path to get it, and you'll see them in one of these days, you know. So now I got the sponsor. I asked him to be my sponsor, and somehow, I don't know where, I forget where it was, but I heard this concept of 12-step calls. You know, I got 30 days sober now, and I want to go on a 12-step call. I'd be like a real alcoholic, you know, like these old crusty old-timers in the corners, you know. So I did. I dug up a 12-step call, and I called up Tim. I said, get in the car. I swear to God, I told my sponsor to get in the car. I love it. You know, he hates it when I say that, but I did. So I picked him up, and we drove, and I watched him do the deal. And I watched him look in the utility drawer. The light's getting ready to shut off. It wasn't all about the alcoholic. Is there milk for the kids in the refrigerator? I said, what are you looking in the refrigerator for? We're supposed to be talking to the drunk. No, it's about the family and the kid and the wife and the whole deal, you know. And I learned so much that night in walking. I just had gratitude. Driving him back in the car that night, I'm driving him back. I said, man, Tim, I learned so much. Thank you so much. I could talk some gratitude right now. And I didn't hear a thing. I didn't hear a word. I peeked over out of the corner of my eyes. I could have swore I saw his head turn around like that Exorcist girl when you say the wrong thing to your sponsor. And he said, uh-uh, pal, you don't talk gratitude. Gratitude is action. Gratitude is not talked about. It's demonstrated. It's not a noun. It's a verb. Don't tell me. Show me. And I recognized that as the truth. Once again, it sunk in. I saw that as the truth. And so I said, okay, man, I got the gratitude. Get me active. He says, okay, Friday was our home group. Now I joined his home group. He says, next Friday you pick up Jim and Dan and take them to our home group, the West Clifton group. And I did. He sent me on an AA mission, man. And I am feeling it good. And I picked up these two guys and took them back there, and I felt great, man. Next week, go pick up Frankie and Ellis and take them. Next week, I picked up Frankie and Ellis. I'm following instructions. I'm doing good stuff. And the next week, I picked up Tom and Eddie, and I took them down to the meeting. And I'm starting to learn, though. I'm starting to learn. So now I hung back a little bit, and I took them down a little later so I could get AA credit for helping the new man, you know. So other people could see me trotting the new guys down the steps, you know. And it's got to be cagey about it. Next week I pick up Tom and Dan, and on the way back I start to think. You know, enough of this. He's down there in the back row drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, eating donuts with all his buddies. I'm out here riding my gas around, picking up all these new guys for him. I walked down the steps, walked up that night and said, hey, man, I'm doing your footwork for you. And his head turned around like that Exorcist girl. And just like that, I don't know where he comes. Just like that, he says, uh-uh, pal, you're doing God's work. I didn't think of that. I said, oh, that's all I had was oh. And at that moment, at the base of the steps of the West Clifton group on a Friday night at 9 o'clock, he gave me the biggest gift he could have given his new guy at that point in his journey. He gave me my new employer. I'm not working for AA. I'm not working for the new guy. I'm not working for him. I'm not working for myself or the meeting. I'm doing God's work. You know, and I saw the truth in those words, I guess. And it gave me renewed, it lifted up my wings just when I was supposed to. And I said, okay, man, so where's God's work taking me next? Okay, you got me. Where's it next? He says, go to Serenity Hall and visit Carl. Serenity Hall is one of the oldest treatment centers in the country. It's on the west side over there. I said, Tim, I got 6 months sober. What am I going to tell a new guy in a treatment center? He says, you got 10 bucks? Buy him a carton of cigarettes. It was a long time ago. So I did. So I picked up a carton of cigarettes, took him up to the treatment center, and I walked up to the doors, and they had this big bench, two burly-looking nurse ratchets guarding the doors of detox, you know. And I walked up, and I said, ma'am, I'm here to visit Carl. And they looked down, and they said, are you a relative of Carl's? I said, no, ma'am, I'm not. They said, well, sorry, we only allow relatives to visit the patients in detox. I said, yes, ma'am, I'm sorry. And I turn, and I'm 5 steps down the hallway, and I hear, hey, you! And I stop, I turn around, and off to the side, there's an open doorway, and there's a little red-haired lady, 100 pounds, sticking her head. She says, hey, "Are you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I'm like, "Geez, holy moly, right? What part of Anonymous doesn't this lady know? Right here in the middle of the hallway." I couldn't believe it. You know, truth be told, I didn't know whether I was or not. But I thought for a moment, I said, "Yes, ma'am, I am." And it must have been the right answer, because she got up off her stool. She come around that desk. She grabbed me by the arm. She drugged me right past those nurses. HIPAA be damned. This is AA business now, you know. She kicks open the doors of detox, and she leaves me there. She comes back out. The door swings shut. The new guys look up at me like, "Who's this loser?" Till they spot the cigarettes. Nothing gets you in the good graces of a bunch of treatment center guys like a carton of Marlboros, man, carrying the message. I walked out of that place 3 hours later. My feet were this high off the ground. Alcoholics Anonymous opened up doors for me that day. Been opening up doors for me ever since. In big ways and in little ways, just open up doors nonetheless. You know, and the back end of that story is probably 10 or 15 years later, that little red-haired lady ends up being my wife's sponsor. You can't write, my own set of miracles, you can't write scripts that sometimes that turn out, Amy and I were talking, you can't plan this stuff. It's we just got to walk the path. New people just walk the path. And so that's the way. And the back end of the back end of the story was my sponsor and the new guy, Carl, it was like my man in the bed, like that picture you see on the wall at AA meetings, my man in the bed. And the three of us have dinner and a meeting on Friday nights for years. And these are relationships. And I would have gone to the wall for any of these guys. These are the relationships I've been looking for in the bars all my life. You know, a real vital, just brothers. You know, just brothers. You know, it's the real deal, not all that fake stuff I was used to in my life. So, life is happening. Good stuff's happening. I'm going on through. I'm getting it. Staying active. I'm all in AA. I ended up in Ikipa. We had Ikipa in Cleveland. Boy, that was a nightmare. My hacky sack days, nothing against young people, please don't. But my hacky sack days are long behind me. I'm no more of that. But I was involved in all kinds of AA in any way I could, you know, and a lot of it was just where I was talking. We used to, my home group is kind of like the heavy hitter group on the east side of Cleveland, and those old timers used to fight over the mop, you know, and it wasn't all flat. And this is like, what I'm doing here tonight, this is the least of it. You know, the real deal is the people that are working behind the scenes, doing the stuff, turning the lights on, shutting them off, you know, sweeping the floors. You know, it's we're the face of AA. How are you going to leave it for other people, you know? This place will be clean as a whistle when we all leave tomorrow afternoon, you know, because we are the face of AA, and curate how we bring ourselves to the world. I forget the word that we use, but we'll do a good job at it, and we'll pay attention. So stuff's happening in life. I ended up, the steel mills closed down, and I had 27 years seniority at that time, and I lost my job, and I decided to go get a blood test. The readings came back a little funny, and I had to go on a year of those interferon treatments. So I lost my job, had to go on the interferon treatments. A lot of you know what I meant, wreckage of the past, you know, basically chemotherapy and a whole bunch of other negative stuff happened. I was 10 years sober when all this happened. 10 years sober, and I was doing all the right things, and I was trying hard. My life fell apart. But I found out, like they say at my home group, what comes to my neighbor's porch sooner or later is going to come to our porch, whether we're sober or not. But are we ready for it? Do we have the sobriety in the bank? Do we have the activity in the bank? Do we have the friends, the fellowship around us? Do we have the sponsor? And, you know, I was fortunate never to have left the basics. You know, I kept the wheel. You know, there was a point in life where I got the AA in my head, you know, and I knew what was going on, and I would do that. And then I got really lucky, and the AA would filter down to my heart. Now I got the AA in my heart. But then I got really lucky, and it filtered down to my feet. And that's where the magic happens. And so when the going gets tough and the feet kept going, and thank God for that. And I ended up getting through the interferon treatments, and the jobs came back. I started a job. In the meantime, now good stuff starts happening in life. And I got a wife. I ended up getting a little wife in Alcoholics Anonymous. Few people know here. And we'd been dating a long time, and you don't want to rush. You know, it's 10 years. you don't want to rush into these things. You know, they told me, Mr. Afraid of Commitment, right? So now we got this good little AA life going. You know, and she's got 30 years now, and she's got her girls on Wednesday nights that come over to the, I call it Estrogen Wednesday, and I get out of Dodge, man. I can't handle it, but so there's 10 women over my house every Wednesday, and it's good. It's a good life, and we're having a lot of fun doing it, and it's vital. You know, we're having in 2009, Elliot Ness's bodyguard passed away at the age of 99 years old. And for years previously, he was sick, and there was things happening, I moved around the corner from him, or we did, and I would have to, they were still living independently in the house I grew up in, and my mom was still around taking care of him, but I had to go help. You know, he'd get stuck in a toilet. I would have to go do things at 2:30 in the morning that I would rather not, but I was able to be there and be the son I was always supposed to have been. I watched my sponsor do these things, and I just copied what my sponsor did, and I saw the way he took care of his people, and then he passed away after the rehab. And my mom and I were in the funeral home making the arrangements, and she looks up at me. She says, "Who the hell's gonna come? All our friends are dead," you know. And she had me. It's 99 and 97. She was. All her friends had long since died, and. You guys know who came. The place was packed. 200 people, the Cleveland Police Honor Guard came. They found out that who he was, and all the people that I had been sitting in meetings with for years and years came. The Knights of Columbus Honor Guard came, and my wife looks up at me, and she says, "Who are all these people?" And I'll tell you what, once again, new people, that's one of the biggest gifts in my sobriety was a look on my mom's face when she says, "Who are all these people that came there to honor her husband when she didn't think there would be anybody there?" She thought the place would be empty. And she was just, I said, "They're just friends, Mom, just friends." Alcoholics Anonymous has a way of changing our perspective on what's valuable in life. You know, things we would have... Just walk past that we previously thought were insignificant in life become sometimes transform into the most important things. Our perspective changes, our view of life changes. You know, we undergo this shift in life. In 2013, my mom passed away at the age of 100 and a half. And she would say, "And don't forget the half." Really, and the same thing happened. The place was packed, you know, I'm in the funeral home. I'm sitting in the line and looking at all these people, and here comes Joy. And Joy was one of our home group members. She had driven 60 miles. She could have just come on Sunday night and given me her condolences, but she drove 60 miles to come to my mom's funeral. And she's walking up in the line. She gets up to me. I says, "Joy, you didn't have to come. You could have just, why not Sunday?" She said, "No." And she stopped me dead, and she drew close, and she says, "If we get sober together, we can damn well bury our dead together, pal." Yeah, and I'm just the people and the experiences, and if my eyes are open, the little things that we experience in Alcoholics Anonymous are some of the most important things that I experience in my life today. You know, and six months later, I'm at my home group, and Joy, there's Joy. She comes up to me at the end of the meeting. She says, "Hey, Paul, can I talk to you for a second?" I said, "Yeah, what you got?" She says, "I just got back from the oncologist today. So I've been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. They gave me 6 months to live. Would you be my pallbearer?" I wasn't expecting that. And of course, you know what I said. Of course, I'll be your pallbearer, Joy, you know. And I'd like to tell you it's because I'm a great guy or something like that. But no, it's because she knew the kind of AA I was brought up in, and that if I said I was going to be there, I would damn well go, I'm going to be there. And I would be there in support of her husband. She was seeding her own funeral with support for her husband, who I'd been sitting next to at the treasurer's table for about 15, 20 years. And 6 months later, that happened. And 6 months later, I did. And I was. And I watched that woman go through that ordeal with dignity and with grace. I used to think courage was Marlboro Man courage, or busting up bars courage, or tough guy courage, you know, all that shallow stuff. But now Joy, the way she went through that, nobody knew. Nobody knew the way she is. Now Joy is my ideal of courage. Alcoholics Anonymous changes our perspective in so many different ways. So there I was. Newberg is, there was an anonymous guy by the name of Dick Poutney who was a Newberg. He was one of those giants. I hate to use the word giant. I was trying to think of another word, but that's all you could describe it. He sponsored half of the west side of Cleveland. He started schools. He was one of those guys. He had all this sobriety and stuff, new guy came up to him at the meeting one night at Newberg, envying his lifetime of sobriety and his years of accomplishment. New guy goes, "Wow, Dick, 30 years. And Dick slammed down his hand like a gay. He says, "I'll trade you even, kid, my 30 years for your 30 days right now." Because Dick knew what the new guy had yet to learn was that the happiness is in the journey, not the destination. Not the destination. It's in the one day at a time, the good and the bad, the ups and the downs, the successes and the failures of life, but doing it sober. Doing it sober, and I didn't understand that when I was new at all. But I understand it today. And new person, I'll trade you even my 32 years for your 32 days right now. You know, just for the privilege and the joy and the pleasure of spending it with you people again, of doing it again. Not the bank account, but the rest of it. You know, it's so shallow. So shallow. I shouldn't even say it. I wish they, can you strike that? If he wakes up, he will. So one of the most important things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is what we did here tonight. We take up a chair, we put a buck in a basket maybe, whether it's here or at our own home groups. We're here for the new people. On Wednesday night or Friday night or whenever you guys do it, you take up a chair, you put a buck in a basket, and you make a newcomer feel welcome. And that's what those people did for me on a Tuesday night to a new guy that was going out and celebrating with $9 in his pocket. The next day, they took up a chair, they put a buck in a basket, and they made a newcomer feel welcome. I hope we're doing that today. I hope we're continuing that today. Anybody in the young side of a year is tasked with going forward. It's never too soon to start that. I'd like to thank you guys for coming. I'd like to thank the committee for all their efforts and everything they do here. I'd like to thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and that old-timer that told me humility is the key. Thank you.